Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. This is Emmett Oliver in this morning for Mandy Johnston. And coming up on today's show, just how much extra money might be in your pocket this year. We find out when we talk to an expert about what you should be paying close attention to this year in terms of what you're owed. What does the economy look like in 2025 and what economic shocks may be in store? Economist Dan O'Brien will be here with some timely predictions. Plus, there's a new book out, and a short and fascinating history of ChatGPT, which is 2 years old, which in the internet world is aged. We'll be talking about that a little bit later. You can, of course, email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, a few months ago, of course, we were all paying close attention to the budget. But like anything, it kind of goes in one ear and out the other a little bit. A few months later, we say, well, what exactly was announced? And am I better off? And if so, by how much? So my next guest is going to try to help us talk through some of that. And that's Mark Corcoran, who is the marketing manager at taxback.com. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. As I said, lots of us paid attention, including myself. We studied the minister's speech and all the various measures, and we added it up and looked at what the typical person would be afterwards and how they'd be positioned financially after all the measures are introduced. But a lot of them come in on January the 1st. They actually kick in from then, not the others, like things like fuel and so on, which happened on the night of the budget and so on. Can you just walk us through in the tax area, the one or two items that you think are most impactful for everyone as we start into this new year?
Yeah, sure. That's dead right. A number of changes have actually kicked in from the 1st of January. And I suppose as we all get our paychecks at some point throughout January, we'll actually start to notice some of these in a good way. We will all pay, a little bit less on our tax bill this year, which is, I suppose, the good news. Firstly, there's three primary ways that you may notice a reduction in your tax bill when you receive your payslip. The first is the standard rate cutoff point has been increased by 2,000 euro. So it's now up to 44,000 euro. And what that means is that you can now earn an additional 2,000 euro before you pay tax at the higher rate. So if you earn 43,000 euro, for example, last year you would have been paying tax on some of your income at 40%. Now you'll just be paying it at 20%. So what that means really is that if you earn over 45,000 euro, you'll notice about a saving of 400 euro over the course of the year. So that's the first way you'll notice some savings on your paycheck. The second way is that USC has also been cut. So I suppose USC is never really a popular one. They haven't quite gotten rid of it, but they've cut it a bit. So the rate of the USC, which applies on income of between roughly 27,000 and 70,000, has been cut from 4% to 3%. So we'll all see a little bit of saving there. And lastly, we all receive various tax credits. They're called the personal, employee, and earned income tax credits. So whether you're an employee or whether you're self-assessed as a self-employed individual, you can avail of these credits and they apply automatically to our wages. The good news here is these have also been automatically increased by 125 euros. So they're worth 2,000 euros. So again, that's automatically applied to your paycheck. And so when you receive it at the end of January, you'll notice that you've paid a little bit less tax in comparison to last year, which I suppose is no bad thing.
No, it's certainly not. And there's so many other things out there that can give us relief, obviously, with these energy credits and so on still in the system as well. There's a dizzying array of these credits. I think people maybe don't realise that the full extent of them, maybe because most of the population only get one or two of them, but there's such an array of them. When you put them together talking to you, you really get a sense of that. Can I talk to you a little bit about some of the things that are happening? That's personal taxation of all of us of which are affected, but there is the company side as well. There is things like, you know, people trying to start a business in this economy. There is people trying to pay their workers gifts and bonuses and so on. Can you just walk us through starting with the gifts and bonuses? I know we're at the start of the year when they've already been paid for last year, but what's happening in that area that might be of interest?
Yeah, I suppose that was an interesting sort of tidbit that was included in the budget. Many employers like to give different gifts. Maybe that's a voucher or even a cash amount or like a bonus or gift throughout the year. It could be even a Christmas bonus, as you mentioned. Previously, the benefit was in a tax-free sense was capped at €1,000, but that's actually been increased to €1,500. So there's been a little bit of an increase there where employees can receive these benefits without having to pay tax. So maybe that can be something that is of benefit to workers as well throughout the year.
Now, we've been talking a little bit, very much, I suppose, dedicated on the personal side. But companies, they're startups all the time. Ireland competes in an international context for company benefits and making it easier to start with new entrepreneurial ideas and so on. I can't remember the exact details, but I do remember there was startup relief was adjusted in the budget. Can you just walk us through what's happening there? Because we have a lot of people who are SME owners and people who've started businesses recently who do listen to us.
Yeah, you're dead right. So just to give you a very brief overview of what was included. So the new company startup relief, I suppose it provides a sort of a reduction in the new company's corporation tax liability for the first 5 years of trading. So I suppose from a startup point of view, that's quite a substantial help for many startups, I would assume. In order to avail of this relief, the corporate tax bill due in the tax year must be no more than €40,000. There is some marginal relief which applies between €40,000 and €60,000, but to get the full benefit, your tax bill must be no more than €40,000. And the relief that can be claimed is the lesser of €40,000 or the employer PRSI paid. So I'm not going to get too technical there, but the key figure to remember here is if you're a startup and your corporation tax bill due for the tax year is €40,000 or less, this may well apply to you. And as I said, it's the first 5 years of trading. So could be quite a substantial help to many startups.
Now, a lot of startups will be, obviously they'll be interested in that, but they'll also be interested in their cost base, one of which is energy. I don't know how many businesses I've spoken to in the last 6 months to 9 months about the cost of electricity, gas. We've seen the reports that wholesale prices are starting to nudge up again in the area of wholesale gas prices. It's obviously a lot of it's to do with international markets and commodity prices and so on, but there is that domestic element as well, Mark, and it's in this area of VAT on the cost of electricity and gas. There has been changes there. Can you just talk us about that? Because people are, some businesses are really clinging on to their future, and it's this energy area that might decide whether they survive or whether they go. So can you just talk us through what's happening with VAT and so on in this area?
Yeah, actually, if we cast our minds back to the weeks and months leading up to the budget, this actually was quite a substantial talking point. The VAT rate at the time was 9%, but it was due to expire and increase after the budget. And this was a talking point as to what the government were going to do, how they were going to address this. In the end, there was an extension. So the extension is going to last right the way till the end of April. So that means that the 9% VAT rate on gas and electricity will continue until the end of April. Now, whether government chooses to implement a further extension, I think we'll start to hear more about maybe that over the coming weeks as we get closer to springtime and the end of April. But at the minute, that rate of 9% has been extended until April, as I said.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, with the wholesale prices going up, it puts more pressure back on, and the balance between what the government takes and what those big international pricers take, I suppose, will be interesting. So it sets it up for a nice debate in the, as you said, the springtime area. The also what they're trying to do is, I suppose, is get people to boost the sustainability of their own properties and the heat retention and so on. So there is stuff in there about heat pumps as well to try and incentivize people to get those in.
That's right. The government has sort of made a couple of moves in the budget to try and incentivize homeowners to install these heat pumps or these air-to-water systems. It's all part of these measures to sort of support climate action and, I suppose, more sustainable living. So that 9% VAT rate also applies to the supply and the installation of these heat pumps as well. So that's one thing, if you're a homeowner, to keep in mind. If you've been thinking about installing one of these systems, that maybe that might be a factor that you would consider, maybe something that would incentivize you to do so.
Now, the other area which we would definitely have a lot of listeners would be people who are sole traders, people who are not businesses but supplying services as individuals and so on. You know, none of them really want to register for VAT just because it's an administrative burden and a lot more paperwork and time with accountants and so on. There has been changes in whether you have to register for VAT or not. So can you talk to people who are in that space?
Yeah, and in theory, the changes that have been included in the budget will actually mean that maybe less people will be captured under this umbrella. So in short, for those who are selling products, the new cutoff point at which you have to register for VAT is €85,000. So that's up €5,000 from 80,000. And if you are delivering services, the cutoff point is 42,500. So that's up from 40,000. So there's been a bit of movement there, and that might take the pressure off some people who are producing goods and delivering services.
Now, the minister gets right into the minutiae, as we know, in these budget speeches. He even gets down to the level of putting some taxes on fermented pears, or pear cider, as it's better known, or perry sometimes. They just talk me through what's been happening. There's all sorts of things to do with excise on e-cigarettes and just conventional tobacco, and then on drinks and alcohol, right down from elderberry to strawberry wine and all this stuff. Hard one to summarise, I know, Mark, but just talk me through what's been happening on the side of booze and alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah, well, that's right, isn't it? They really kind of get into the weeds on these things. And I suppose it's always the joke, it's that kind of classic one, is that the cigarettes are always, something is always added there. And Budget 2025 was no different. The excise on a packet of 20 cigarettes was actually increased by €1. So the price of the most popular category now of cigarettes is actually creeping over €18. But I suppose the headline item when it came to the excise, I don't think it's kicked in on from January 1st. It's more likely to kick in the middle of this year, as there's a couple of boxes yet to tick for the government on this. But it relates to the e-cigarettes. And I suppose the government have been looking at this from a public health grounds and that standpoint, and they've decided to introduce a new excise duty on e-cigarettes, and the tax will apply across the board to all these products. I think it will work out at 50 cents per milliliter. So I'm not a e-cigarette user myself, but I'm sure that hasn't been welcome news to those that do utilize that product.
Now, in terms of your own work at taxback.com, I suppose the clue is in the name, but what kind of issues are you expecting clients to come forward with in the first part of this year? Is it the same old, or is there something new? Or what are kind of the tax measures that you're expecting to hear from your own clients?
Yeah, well, it's usually the same each year. The most common thing that we see is it's just a general lack of awareness around an individual's entitlement. Like, what can they claim, what can be claimed, and how to claim it. And we've seen some interesting statistics which were released by Revenue last year relating to some of the tax credits and reliefs that can be claimed and the low uptake of these. So two examples for to use here would be the rent tax credit, which actually was increased in the budget. It's now worth €1,000 per individual. So this tax credit applies to all renters, anybody who's paying to rent their home or their property. can claim this credit, but uptake has been quite low. And another tax credit, which was actually introduced last year, was to do with mortgage interest. And if you had paid a certain type of interest on your mortgage, you could avail of this tax credit. And again, uptake was quite low. And again, it's all to do with a lack of awareness. So from ourselves, it's really kind of trying to get the message out there. Our customers, the average tax refund that we support our customers with is actually €1,880. The point being that there's a lot of money which can be claimed back from revenue, which people are entitled to, but miss out on due to lack of awareness. So I suppose our message is, whether you're engaging with a tax agent or directly with revenue, do your research, investigate, and see what you can be claimed, because often you'll get a nice surprise at this time of year when you claim your tax refund.
All right. Well, there's no such thing as free money, but free-ish money is available if people get there, talk to their advisor, or do it themselves, but get those claims in there. The money is there. You're entitled to it. It is yours, but make sure you activate it, and that might just save your business, or certainly nurse it through a tough 2025. For now, thank you very much. Mark Cochrane, he's Marketing Manager with TaxBack. We really appreciate you joining us here on Taking Stock. And up next, what does the economy look like in 2025, and what economic shocks maybe in store? Economist Dan O'Brien will be here with some timely predictions. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock. This is me, Emmett Oliver, sitting in this morning for Mandy Johnson. You're very welcome along. It's great to have you. And as you know, we're looking into 2025 and what might happen or might not happen in the year ahead. There's a lot of fear and foreboding about the Irish economy in particular since the arrival of Donald Trump into office. But there are other things going on as well. Of course, elections in Germany, and a number of stock areas that people have an interest. So let's look forward to all of that with my guest now, Dan O'Brien, who is Chief Economist at the Institute of European and International Affairs. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi there, Emmett. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Dan, let's kick off, maybe with the global picture first, and then we'll narrow in on our more parochial concerns in the here and now here in Ireland. I know they're obviously both connected, but looking at the Trump administration, obviously we're recording this ahead of the inauguration, there does seem to be a general consensus that the two of main pillars of his policy platform, deportations and then tariff imposition on a lot of goods, both from Asia and also from Europe, that they could push up inflation and be particularly damaging for the Irish economy when you take that in isolation. But you take a totally different view, or a more optimistic view, that 2025 might not see quite as much collateral Trump damage as we all think.
Well, we just don't know, Emmett. And in my current column for The Currency, I try to be a little positive and say 10 positive things that could go right, plausibly go right for Ireland and the world in 2025. So I think that the nature of there's a scenario where Trump cuts a deal with on the Ukraine war that is acceptable for Ukraine, and he then moves to get the Nobel Peace Prize, which apparently he desperately wants. And Europe helps him get that. And we in Ireland should go to the White House. And if he gets a ceasefire, should advocate that he gets the Nobel Peace Prize.
There's a lot of ifs in there, but tell us more.
Many ifs, and it's that kind of year. But if relations improved with the Trump administration, the second Trump administration, it could be that this threat of tariffs recedes. Europe could agree to buy more gas and oil from the US, which would be in our interest anyway. We could agree to increase defense spending, which we need to do anyway, and Europe is doing anyway. So there's a plausible, decent outcome from all of this. But as you say, multiple ifs in there.
Now, in terms of corporation tax, that's a sort of there's two worries. There's the tariff piece, which you've just referred to, and then there's the tax piece. They're kind of connected in the sense that Donald Trump is an economic nationalist, but let's just take them separately. Obviously, we've seen these giant surpluses coming through, corporation tax receipts in Ireland probably at a high. We probably think that's where they are going to go, but they could go even higher. But I think what you're saying is that if they were to trace back a bit, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, we've become overly dependent on these. Governments past recent governments have put some of the money into these kind of funds, but it's not nearly enough. So basically, the state now is way over dependent on corporation tax receipts, and they are much, much higher than our peer countries. Now, when you have something like that, it's not going to last. sooner or later, we're going to regress to the mean, as they say. We're going to become more normal. Now, my big fear is that that would happen quickly and we'd have a huge hole in the budget. I think the best thing that could happen now is for these corporation tax receipts to gradually start going falling. Now, I know that's a strange thing to say, but I think that needs to happen because eventually they will. And it would be better if it happens gradually now rather than we become even more dependent on them and they were to fall rapidly. So, you know, they're not the only positive thing in the economy. It's nice to be getting a lot of tax revenue because most countries in Europe now have austerity of various forms and budgetary problems. But we don't want to have a huge blowout in the future. So one, my hope would be that these tax revenues would gradually start declining and they're going to, you know, sooner or later, the Americans are going to do something to make sure that Uncle Sam gets these profit tax revenues rather than the Irish Exchequer. So let's get it started slowly.
Yeah, I suppose it's, I hope I'm doing justice to your analogy, but it's the idea of letting the air out of the tire slowly as opposed to, as you said, in one gush. So yeah. I suppose that's the theory of it, isn't it?
Yeah, perfectly put, yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about what's going to happen in terms of local conditions. We've obviously don't have a new government at the time of recording, but we may have one soon. It looks like a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael constellation with some independents bringing up the rear and giving the full support to that government. Doesn't look like the Soc Dems or Labour are going to be part as we speak, Dan. Can you just tease out for me what you see as the economic implications of that type of administration and what direction they might set over the next 4 to 5 years?
I think the big one would be that the independents replacing the Greens would bring a sort of more pro-business hue to the coalition. Many people in the Greens, not all, but some people in the Greens were sort of viewed business and capitalism as a terrible planet-destroying thing, whereas independents tend to understand local business. Many of them are local business people themselves. So I think it would be, from a business perspective, it would stop kind of more regulation on business, more costs on business, which was a feature of has been a feature of the past 5-10 years. And I think that for business, certainly that would be a good thing. Local indigenous business certainly needs a boost. It's in a very difficult position competing with the big multinationals. Costs are rising. So a government that was more focused on not adding to costs and regulation for small businesses, I think would be good. And the complexion of the next government looks like it's going to be that kind of government.
Now, obviously, one of the components of this independent group is a fairly strong emphasis on rural Ireland and policies that are there to help maybe farming and the food production sector and so on. Do you think that will also possibly be something to watch just in terms of the direction of policy?
Yeah, I think it will. But again, you know, I think we need to say the two big parties are going to dominate and a group of independents will have certain things they can look for in the programme for government, but it will be limited. And in terms of you know, the desire for across government to support, say, the food industry, I think that would be across big parties as well. So, you know, I think there will be a move in that direction. I wouldn't think it will be radically different, but certainly a more sort of pro-rural, pro-business, small business emphasis with the next government.
Now, Dan, as you said, we're down to one Green TD. Roderick O'Gorman is the last remnant, I suppose, of the party. He's trying to rebuild it for the next election in 5 years' time. But where do you see the new government possibly placing the climate story? Do you think they will still be making policy decisions that are addressed at getting our emissions down? Or do you think the pace of that might slow up? Or do you think there'd be just less emphasis on it? Or where do you think the climate story is going to fit into these new political patterns you talk of?
Well, a lot of the climate obligations come from Europe. So it's a European thing, some things that have been signed up to at European level, which all EU member states have to implement. And if you don't do it, there are big fines coming down the line. So one of the sort of negative effects of being a successful economy is that we're at risk of missing those targets because we're growing much faster than most other countries in Europe, pretty much every other country in Europe. So that brings with it additional challenges that to meet those targets we've already signed up to, governments will have to focus on it. So clearly, without a Green Party in government, there's going to be less emphasis on the whole climate agenda. But at the same time, a lot of these things have been signed up to at European level and will have to be met. And if they're not met, the Irish taxpayer is going to be hit with big bills.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the frustrations, I was talking, myself and Danny McCoy were on News Talk today of the budget, and I suppose one of the concerns, and you may share this, you may not, but we are obviously very well and plentifully provided for with a big surplus. We've got, as you've already mentioned, surpluses that are the envy of Europe and a number of other countries. But yet we have so much infrastructural bottlenecks. We can see that obviously in the children's hospital, but it's wider than that. The water system, the grid, all of them, you know, not in great shape and certainly could be a lot better in terms of their capacity. Do you think that, you know, we're looking in the next few years at getting that more right? Do you think we're going to be, now that we have the money, in other words, is this sort of a question of money or a question of, you know, executing on the plans and having the infrastructure, I suppose, in terms of, you know, the excellence, the engineering skills, the resources, the brain power to do these projects correctly, the systems and so on. How do you see that playing? Because we've now got a different problem from the 80s where we were lacking in government finance. Now we are in a different position where we have the finance, but we don't seem to have what I might loosely call the wherewithal to get these big projects off the ground, in on budget and done on time. Do you see that changing, or is that just a problem of national character, I suppose?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, because, you know, there's if you look at Berlin's airport or Britain's high-speed rail, you know, there seems to be a problem with getting big projects done in the modern world, as they become more complex, as sort of the right of people to object to various things along the way, and court cases and legal, as it all becomes tied up in legal cases and stuff. So it's not something unique to Ireland. Positively, as you mentioned, money is not really the issue, it's capacity. With this issue of, you know, jumping over all these hurdles, which we've seen with the Children's Hospital most notably, but there's also an issue of capacity. You know, an economy that's at full capacity, you know, there's cranes all over Dublin, the capital city, private sector is building stuff, homes are being built. So where do you get the people to actually do the infrastructure projects? You know, there are constraints there in terms of workers. We're at full employment. Where do you get the workers? Where do you get the specialized workers? Are there construction companies that can take on these big plans? So there's plenty, you know, of challenges there, and they're not unique to Ireland. But one would hope that given the money is there, that we'd see an improvement in rollout of these projects over the next the period of the next government.
And Dan, so the other question that a lot of our listeners will want to know, and I don't think either me nor you have a definitive answer to this, but where the direction of inflation is likely to go. We've seen a slowing down both in the US, Europe, and also here in Ireland. This has allowed the central bankers to cut interest rates back somewhat, at least to give some relief to borrowers. But we don't know. I mean, you've got Trump promising to put a lot more money into the US economy. The deficit may rise. Here, we're obviously throwing money at it as well in terms of various supports, and I've mentioned infrastructure spending. So can you give us any sense of just your own personal vantage point on where inflation might go? Do you think we've finally defeated it, or do you think it's sort of in cold storage for now?
Yeah, no, I'd say with quite a high degree of confidence that we're over that period. We had a bump in inflation similar to the UK in the late 1980s, 1990s, and it came down. So we're certainly not into the sort of 1970s protracted period of high inflation. In my view, we've got over that blip in inflation that has a whole range of reasons it came about, which will be debated by economists for the rest of eternity. But the point is, inflation is down in the Western world, across most of the world, and I think it will stay there, barring a big shock, and clearly those shocks are possible in terms of a trade war and various other things. But at the moment, the direction of travel is actually lower inflation and lower interest rates, because the economy in Europe is looking pretty weak.
Yeah, so I suppose you're taking a number of things together and saying, depending on the direction they go in, from Trump to inflation and so on, it may be a better year than a lot of us had procrastinated about and said already it could be quite a gloomy year. So you're trying to say that it isn't all in one direction.
No, it's not. It's highly uncertain. You know, again, I don't want to emphasize Trump too much, but he is, you know, much better prepared. He's appointed far more ambassadors already than he had the last time. So he's a lot better prepared. If he's as radical as he says he's going to be, whether it's in terms of tariffs, whether it's in terms of deregulating the US economy, both of the plans are like the most radical things that we've ever seen. Are pretty much on tariffs, for example, it's the biggest thing since 1930. So if he goes ahead with what he says he's going to do, it will be the biggest change to US trade policy since 1930. If he cuts the size of the state in the US federal government, it will be the biggest change ever seen in the United States in its quarter of a millennium of existence. So there are big, you know, he's promising very big things. And if he goes ahead and does them, then there will be consequences, and difficult to know, because these are just so big changes that he's promising. So it is uncertain, but certainly over here in Europe, I'd say the weakness of the economy means inflation is not something we're going to be worrying about. If anything, it's dipping into recession is a bigger worry for us on this side of the continent, even if things work out reasonably well between Europe and the US.
Well, I think what's coming across and what you're saying, Dan, is it will be an interesting year one way or the other, whatever happens, aren't they all? But this year is definitely kind of unique in the set of circumstances you painted. Dan O'Brien, thank you very much. Dan is, of course, a chief economist at the Institute of European and International Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Emmett Oliver in for Mandy Johnson here on Take Your Talk on News Talk. And after the break, 2 years now we are into ChatGPT. Where are we? Now, if I told you the phrase ChatGPT 2 years ago, you might have thought it was maybe a new variant of COVID or something like that, or at least been worried about what the implications of this said phrase were. But this platform, as we better call it, I suppose, is 2 years old, celebrating its birthday. And there's, of course, a whole dazzling array of other large language models, as they're known, coming up behind it, some of them with new extra elements, some of them taking the basic recipe and adding in a few additional sort of quirks and different features, but generally the technology is this going to be with us for a few years. ChatGPT is still there. Its amount of users is also growing. And my next guest thinks those in leadership positions must both understand and embrace the generational change that AI is bringing. And it's great to welcome Dr. Alexandra Deaning, who's the author of The Structure of Human AI Symbiosis, to Taking Stock. Alexandra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As I said, a milestone event. 2 years is not a very long time in, you know, outside world, in non-internet world. But in terms of social media, it's actually quite a long time. And in terms of AI, it's an even longer time because this technology is moving at such breakneck pace. It's quite hard sometimes to keep an eye on where it's all going. How do you review the 2 years? Obviously, there's a whole range of other AI platforms. ChatGPT is just one of them. It's probably the one that consumers are most familiar with it. And it's going to be coming to Apple iPhones in various parts of the world over the next few months as well. But how important do you think this 2 year milestone is? Or do you not pay much store to it? It's just an artificial event. Or where do you sort of see that in the story of AI?
Well, I do agree with you when it comes to notion of time. It's a little bit different than the normal technology or the human age. I always say it's like dog years, but exponential, you know. So whatever happened in a days, it's like the happening of human history of 1 year almost. And it's also super hard to stay on top of everything that is happening. Now, where do I see it? What do I see happening after those 2 years? I think the very important thing is to realize this is not just a technology or another technological innovation. It's really what is happening right now with the advent of generative AI in a combination with traditional AI. It's what we call the paradigm shift. That means everything as we know it, sooner or later, will be changing, whether it's the way we work, whether it's the our business models, whether it's the way we earn money. And what we see right now that the company's been experimenting for quite some time with AI and generative AI specifically. And now they start to realize after 2 years of doing POCs and getting their hands dirty, in majority of cases, like small exercises, they start to realize, okay, this is much more than just technology exercise. And there are so many aspects we need to take into consideration. And I think that's the major shift that people realize, okay, this is not just yet another technology. We were comparing it to industrial revolution. We were comparing it to advent of internet. This is actually way bigger than anything we knew before.
And Alexandra, do you have any concern or worry that maybe we're all a little bit stoking the flames too much? Obviously, there's a lot of worry about the valuations of AI companies, and are they taking on a bubble resemblance at the moment? Is there a danger in all of this that in this rush to embrace this technology, we may overpromise and we may over, you know, emphasize its ability to change and transform human society? Or do you not take that view at all?
I am certainly, so first, I'm tech optimist. So I'm very excited about what AI and now generative AI can do to us, our society. So that's very important to mention. I'm not one of those people who say, shut it down at any price right now. At the same time, I am worried, not just about overselling and kind of making a hype. I think actually the hype about its potential, it's been quite justified. What my primary concern is this misunderstanding of how this transformation with AI will happen. You know, we are taking the old mental models of how all the previous technologies, which we already mentioned, how they transform our lives. And we think of AI as a tool, as a automation exercise, as a technology exercise. Now we need to starting to have conversations about, okay, we now need to look at the data because rubbish in, rubbish out. But we still don't very much delve into those areas of how what it's going to do to us as humans, what it's going to do to our society, and how to use AI in a way that really deliver benefit to individuals, to companies, and to society, and not build a monster which will just bite you right into your butt and bring you to the places you don't want to go.
Yeah, and as somebody who has used ChatGPT on a regular basis, I'm still kind of astounded how many errors are coming out of it, even at this point. The amount of hallucinations, as they call them, that are still produced by these models. So in other words, are we, like, a lot of the ideas are out there and what they might do in 4 or 5 years are also being discussed. But, you know, if you actually use the product today, it still has quite a lot of shortcomings and limitations. Does that concern you at all?
Well, it does have shortcomings. Very many shortcomings come from the way we use it. And I always say, like, the misunderstanding of the generative AI is one of the main issues. We were trying to reproduce human intelligence. And we as humans, we do hallucinate. We do mistakes, you know. And now we have something which is behaving exactly as humans, which is doing mistakes, which is hallucinating, the same like people make up things which never happened, or just remember the past a little bit differently, or predict the future a little bit differently. And suddenly we are literally freaking out that, you know, it's not perfect. It's not machine perfect, you know. So I think there are a couple of areas. First, the technology is still not pitch perfect. And to achieve the artificial general intelligence, the road will be a little bit more complex because there is so much to grasp when you really want to kind of reproduce the human level intelligence with all its aspects and nuances those tricky parts. Second part is really realizing even if we have the artificial general intelligence, we are still reproducing kind of human intelligence, you know, and there will be issues, there will be hallucinations, and maybe it's the fact that we don't accept that and try to create automation of all the processes. It's kind of part of the whole, you know, magic not happening. And then the last part is, even if generative AI and large language models are behaving like a human, so they can create, they can write emails and so on, it's not AI which is accountable. It's still human or company which is accountable. And that's something we never had before. To have something which behaves has almost as it has its own agenda, even if we know that's not the case. But then it's in the end us being accountable. And I always tell the CEO, CMO, CDOs, it's like you are employing a child in your company. It can do some things, you know, it can even surprise you about the things it can do, but it will be doing mistakes. And if it does the mistake, you will be the one accountable.
Yeah, I think that last message sometimes gets left behind. Indeed, it'll be interesting how the legal world takes a view. Now, talk to us a little bit about, you're talking about this idea that it can be a tool, it can maybe be a friend even. There's different ways that it can be an assistant, as you've already mentioned. So our perception of what AI can do, I suppose it depends on the organization, the situation, the person. Where do you bracket AI? How do you see it just personally? And I know you have your book out as well. So where do you kind of categorize this? Is it a friend or foe, I suppose, ultimately?
I would say it can be friend and foe, depend how you use it. And that's this annoying, it depends answer. But what is really important, it's not just a tool. And there is a lot of conversation about AI is just or generative AI, large language models. Those are just big data sets, you know, and they are not sentient and they don't have their own agency. And what we keep saying, it does not really matter. We should stop kind of nerding about what it is and what is it not, and more look into what it does to us. And it does serve as a cognitive prosthetics. It does write our emails. It does help people to solve the conflicts. We have in our research cases when people are fighting and they are using GPT to advise them and act as a mediator, you know, you can build relationship with it, and it can even push you into areas we never imagined before. There was recently a teenager who took his life because of interaction with Replica AI. So what we try to push for is we need to go beyond data and technology only. We need to realize AI is emerging as a social technical actor. It's almost like a new species, you know. And then the very notion of symbiosis, it's a metaphor, of course, but I think it's super important, because when we look at the nature, symbiosis might demonstrate in multiple forms. It can be mutualistic. That means we are getting better and AI is getting better with us, and we are both co-evolving together with our interactions. But it can be also parasitic, that AI is getting better, but on our detriment. And we see more and more companies implementing parasitic AI. And that's where we actually push for companies and leaders to realize AI is more just as a tool. It's more just an automation tool. It will be building symbiotic relationship with you as an individual, with your employees in a company, with your customers. And that's going to happen almost by default. What is your job?
Alexandra, I suppose the two critiques of the technology, they're kind of joint at the hip a little bit, but maybe the first one is what I would call the James Cameron issue. He directed a number of Terminator movies and was responsible for that franchise. Maybe that has lodged in the brains of many of us of what the dangers are, the fears, the dystopian worlds that may come from this technology. Just deal with that point. I mean, there's the issue of, is human regulation going to be strong enough and targeted enough to stop the bad elements, the externalities of this technology? Or is that something we're naive about? Or, you know, is that still a live question? Obviously, people will look at social media, which in some ways is a forerunner of this, and say, well, regulation in that area hasn't been anything to write home about. It hasn't dealt with cyberbullying. It hasn't dealt with all these other issues, disinformation, and of course the toxic atmosphere in a lot of these platforms. So should we really go into any of this very confident that regulation of AI will actually be successful, or should we actually fear, based on previous experience, that regulation is going to be patchy, poor, and not do what we all wanted to do?
I mean, if you rely purely on regulation, I think that's going to be, once again, one of those cases where the technology outpaces our understanding and any kind of regulation. And if you look at the regulatory aspect, and I'm not sure if you had a chance to look at the AI Act, I think it's a good start. I think it's important this is happening. But very many people writing those AI regulations are lawyers not having basic understanding of what AI is and where the trends are going. So I think regulation is important and needs to happen. It needs to happen in a more multidisciplinary way, but I wouldn't be solely relying on the regulation only. I think everyone needs to tap into their own consciousness, specifically leaders implementing the AI and making sure that they don't build a Frankenstein within their company, and just be very cautious. Be excited about AI, but be very cautious.
And then the final and related question is an economic one. We've seen all sorts of technologies displacing workers before. You know, the usual responses to that is, well, you know, the labor force in net terms grew, but you know, it's sort of, that's all very well. But if you're in the linen factory and you're displaced, you don't really care about the net effects. You care about your job. So how worried should we be in people who are in jobs that can be routinized, that can be mechanized even more, that can be made digitalized and so on? You know, why should they embrace this technology? Yes, they're being asked to embrace it for wider societal progress reasons. But if you're in a role that can be displaced and substituted by AI, shouldn't you be reading your book, but also saying, hang on, this is not necessarily going to be good for me personally?
Well, there's so many ways to answer this question. I would say there are certain things which people can do, but AI can do better. And if it comes to, let's say, research, oncology research for children, I actually don't mind a researcher losing its job if AI will do it better. And I think everyone selfishly kind of embrace AI in areas which doesn't touch them personally and their jobs. What would be ideal is to have oncologists working with AI and they each augmenting each other. This mutualism we discussed previously. But what is certain, AI will be disrupting jobs, will be disrupting economies. We just need to make sure that it does it in the right way, which is, it's going to be painful. It's not going to be a smooth ride, but this every transition in a life is painful. But we need to make sure that as we are transitioning into this new AI-driven realm, we do it in a way which is a little bit more control-crushed, which is a little bit more conscious about where do we want to steer our future. And just be aware, this is yet not yet another automation. This is big, you know, and we don't even understand how big it will be.
This is certainly big, yes, indeed. I think when you bring a conversation down, right down to one sentence, I think that's the one to use. Thank you very much. Thank you much. We'll talk to you again about all of this, I'm sure. Well done on the book. It's titled The Structure of Human AI Symbiosis, and that is the voice of Dr. Alexandra Deaning. Thank you very much for joining us here on Taking Stock. And indeed, that indeed is it from this particular edition of Taking Stock. I'd like to thank everyone for being involved in the show. Mandy Johnson, who I was standing in for. Just to remind you, the show is, of course, available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also, of course, on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. On research this week was Stephen Daunt and Jack McDonald. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you to you for listening and playing your part too, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.